countrymen, by the love of God, by your regard to your estates, your wives and your children, by your concern for liberty and the Church of England, by your compassion for your country, arise as one man in defence of your prince, your constitution and your church.
As Jeremy Black has explained, in Handel's time, religious identity was a defining aspect of national identity, and devotion to the national church was a mark of patriotism. The Jews of the Oratorio forswear the idol-worshipping practices of their Hellenistic overlords, which had begun to infect and disunite their own ranks. The Protestant English, similarly, feared the subversive activities of disloyal Catholics in their midst, not to mention the largely Catholic communities of Scotland. Rededication of the nation to the true faith is a common theme of both government propaganda during the rebellion and of Handel's oratorio. In the next part of the oratorio, we will hear Handel making a marvellously clear distinction between mindless idol worship, for which read Roman Catholicism, and the true religion, for which read Protestantism, at the moment when his oratorio Israelites vow never to bow down to gods made of sticks and stones. Judas Maccabeus clearly refers to the horror of foreign war as well as civil war in its poignant prayer for peace.
O grant it, heaven, that our long woes may cease, and Judah's daughters taste the calm of peace, sons, brothers, husbands to bewail no more, tortured at home or havoced in the war.
By the time of our oratorio's first performance, Cumberland was back in the Continental War. The Allies were doing not very well at all. There was another invasion scare. Peace was still 2 years away. In that context, the celebrations of unity and safety at the end of Judas Maccabeus seem more like wishful thinking than triumphalism. And the famous chorus and march that sounds most like triumphalism, and is now the most famous part of the oratorio, "See the Conquering Hero Comes," wasn't actually heard at the first performance because Handel hadn't written it yet. It comes from his next oratorio, Joshua, where it was such a success that he sensibly implanted it into later performances of Judas Maccabeus. But as the 2009 Edinburgh Festival reaction showed, that hasn't stopped See the Conquering Hero from dominating our take on the oratorio. Which is a shame, because the real story of Judas Maccabeus and what prompted it is actually so much more interesting.
No Conquering Hero was presented by Ruth Smith, and the reader was Oliver Soden. It was produced in Cardiff by Martin Smith. No relation. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall and this live performance of Handel's oratorio, Judas Maccabeus, in which John Mark Ainslie sings the title role, Alistair Miles is his brother Simon, Rosemary Joshua, the Israelitish woman, Christine Rice, the Israelitish man, and Tim Mead sings the messenger, with a choir and orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, directed from the harpsichord by Lawrence Cummings.
The plot is quite truncated, of course, even from the biblical text, and you get quite a lot of information in some of the recitatives. You suddenly realise about a whole battle that happened in the course of 5 seconds, and then you go on to an aria, because, of course, I think what Handel is really interested in is the emotional side of the delivery of the news. And you get the fervent prayers of the Israelites, the chorus, and they're forever being assailed by bad information. When we start the piece, Mattathias, their leader, has died and they're in mourning and they can't believe things can be good again. They've sort of lost their way. And then, of course, as Judas takes them through, they find themselves. But they don't do it in the right way because, of course, they are human and so they don't worship God in the right way. They still believe in their pagan idols that are left over from the oppression, and they lose their way, so they get punished by God, but then they get lifted up again at the end. And of course, the interesting thing is the role of Israelitish woman and Israelitish man, who in a sense are more like the traditional chorus. They actually take the emotional value of the story that's going on and comment on it and take it forward and develop it in a beautiful way.
Well, earlier I asked Christine Rice and Rosemary Joshua, who sing the roles of the Israelitish man and woman, how easy it's been to make their characters living, breathing individuals.
It's quite tricky, actually, because I think they're so reflective as characters. They're listening and they are reflecting on what's happening, commenting on what's happening, and trying to express the emotions of a huge collective group of people. But I'm not sure whether they have an individual voice.
No, I don't think they do, really. I think they're sort of every man and every woman.
Yes. I don't think we're there to be identified with as such. I think we're really there to express the plight of the Jewish people and their strived for liberty.
Yes. I mean, we comment on what's happening here within the court, if you like. But all the outside information, all the drama, comes via messengers, mm-hmm. which is not you or I. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank goodness for the messengers, otherwise we'd be completely in the dark.
Yes! Where would the plot be?
No, we'd have no idea what was going on.
Christine, this is the first time you've sung it. Have there been discoveries for you?
Well, actually, do you know what I've enjoyed most about it is that, particularly with the operas, but the oratorios as well, you tend to get five or six arias, a handful of recits, and maybe, if you're lucky, one duet. Whereas, actually, with Rosie, I have four duets and four arias. So I'm really enjoying that aspect of it. I love the sort of collaboration.
Christine Rice and Rosemary Joshua. The second part of Judas Maccabeus begins with the hair-raising chorus, "Fallen is the Foe," as the Israelites energetically celebrate their victory over the invaders from both Syria and Samaria. Then come arias for the Israelitish man and woman, Christine Rice and Rosemary Joshua, whom we just heard from, praising the victorious hero who fought like a lion. Judas himself insists the praise and thanks are due to heaven alone. But the celebrations are cut short by the arrival of a messenger with the news that the emperor Antiochus has sent an army from Egypt to crush the Israelites. In the magnificent aria and chorus, "Ah, wretched Israel," the people fall to weeping and wailing. But Simon tells them not to despair. They must turn to God. He reminds them of the many times the Jewish people have been saved by their God. Judas then leads them with the rallying cry, "Sound an alarm, your silver trumpet sound," which steadily builds in excitement. At the beginning of the third part, the high priest sings a beautiful aria, "Father of Heaven," as the lights are lit. He tells how the people are preparing to celebrate as the ritual cleansing of the temple in Jerusalem takes place, an act commemorated every year in the Festival of Lights, which became Hanukkah. But now a messenger, sung by a countertenor, Tim Mead tonight, brings news of the rout of an invading army from Kafar Salama, despite its terrifying elephants, by the fearless Judas Maccabeus. That's the prelude to the oratorio's best-known music, the exultant march, "See the Conquering Hero Comes," as, in truly Olympian vision, to martial drum rolls, we're treated to images of flutes leading the dances of those crowned with wreaths of myrtle twined with roses. In "Sweet Flow the Strains," Judas asks that those fallen in battle should be remembered. Finally, the Israelites' ambassador to Rome brings the welcome news that a treaty's been reached to protect Judea as an independent nation. And the Israelites give thanks. Lawrence Cumming in the pre-prom event earlier was making us all laugh a great deal, I must say. He confessed to being a very bad double bass player himself, as well as playing the harpsichord extremely well. And he said that as far as the harpsichord part is concerned, in a bigger venue, you have to play more notes. And he said, "I'm playing as many notes as I can this evening," as you can well imagine. He also talks hilariously about going for naughty intervals with his colleague on the other harpsichord in the orchestra. The instruments are sitting nose to nose. And now, here with the conductor, Lawrence Cumming, are tonight's soloists. John Marr Gainsley in the title role, Alistair Miles, his brother Simon, Rosemary Joshua, the Israelitish woman, Christine Rice, the Israelitish man, and Tim Mead, the messenger. And we're going to hear part two of Judas Maccabeus. Thank you.
Thank you. Second course, as once your fathers did in Midian, saying, the sword of God and Gideon. It was the Lord that for his Israel fought, and this a wonderful salvation wrought. Giant.
Thank you. comforted. Nor think these plagues are sent for your destruction, but for chastisement. Heaven oft in mercy punishes, that sin may feel its own demerits from within, and urge not utter ruin. Turn to God and draw blessing from his iron rod.
Effective his design, while rage his leader and Jehovah mine. Sound an alarm, sound an alarm, your silver trumpet sound, and go the brave and only brave, and only brave around. Call the brave, call the brave, and only brave around. Sound an alarm, your silver trumpet sound, your trumpet sound, your trumpet sound. And call the brave and holy brave, and call the brave and holy brave, and holy brave around. Call the brave, call the brave. Justice with courage is a thousand men, is a thousand men. Justice with courage, justice with courage is a thousand men, is a thousand men. Is a thousand.
desiring every breast. We may divide our cares, the field be thine, O Judas, and the sanctuary mine. For Zion, holy Zion, seat of God, in ruinous heaps is by the heathen trod. Such profanation calls for swift redress. If e'er in battle Israel hopes success. Oh.
hearted stone. Oh,
The Israelites defiant that they'll never bow down to idols of stone. That brings us to the end of the second part of Judas Maccabeus in this live performance from the BBC Proms. The final part begins with the high priest's aria, Father of Heaven. Then a man and a woman in the restored temple offer thanks in what will become the Festival of Lights. Soon after comes the news of Judas's victory over the invaders and his welcome home to the famous chorus, See the Conquering Hero Comes, the tune borrowed for the hymn, Thine Be the Glory. And right at the end, just before the final Hallelujah chorus, another ravishingly beautiful duet for the Israelitish man and woman, accompanied by a pair of flutes, one of only 2 points in the whole evening when Handel brings in the flutes. And it's one of Lawrence Cummings' favourite moments in the whole oratorio.
host, arrayed in coat of mail, their massy shields of gold and brass flashed lightning o'er the fields, while the huge tarbacked elephants displayed a horrid front. But Judas, undismayed, met, fought, and vanquished all the rageful train.
Thank you.
Israel's Lord and Due obsequies prepare to those who bravely fell in war. To Eleazar special tribute pay. Through slaughtered troops he cut his way to the distinguished elephant and went beneath the stabbed monster, triumphing a glorious death.
Great Senate of Imperial Rome, with a firm league of amity, I come. Rome, whate'er nation dare insult us more, will rouse in our defense a veteran power, and stretch a vengeful arm by land or sea, to curb the proud and set the injured free.
Handel's other jubilant Hallelujah chorus, ending his oratorio, Judas Maccabeus, first performed on the 1st of April, 1747. And we're told went off with very great applause. And you can hear it's getting the same reception tonight. Soloists on the stage, John Mark Ainslie sang the title role, Alistair Miles was Simon and the Ambassador. Rosemary Joshua, the Israelitish woman, Christine Rice, the Israelitish man, Tim Mead, the messenger and the high priest, with the choir of the Enlightenment and the orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, leader Addison Bury. The performance was directed from the harpsichord by Lawrence Cummings. Lawrence Cummings, resplendent, the only word, in a quasi-Handelian ghetto, not breeches and hose, but a cutaway coat and a fabulously flamboyant evening shirt with a cascade of Elton John ruffles down the front. Applause there for the trumpeters. Well, apparently some bloke's been banging on about Handel all week on Radio 3, and he hasn't finished yet. Composer of the week's choice, handful of five significant years in his career, tomorrow reaches 1749. That's at 12 noon and at 6:30 before tomorrow night's prom. And you can catch any episodes you might have missed on the website, as indeed through the Listen Again facility, you can hear tonight's prom and all the others in the season for 7 days after the original broadcast. Well, as the applause continues here at the Albert Hall, our tale of war and peace has come to an end. Time for me to return you to the oasis of tranquility, which always will be Radio 3 Continuity and Broadcasting House, and John Shea.
Thank you very much to Some Bloke, or Donald MacLeod, as we like to call him. And we're back at the Royal Albert Hall for our next prom tomorrow evening. That's the first of five concerts being given by the West Eastern Divan Orchestra, conducted by Daniel Barenboim. That's at 7:30 tomorrow evening. This is BBC Radio 3. It's now 27 minutes to 11, and we come to this evening's feature, the second of three programmes this week, under the title of Great British Ideas. Tonight, Tristram Hunt looks at the curious influence of the Romantic Young England movement, led by Benjamin Disraeli in the 1840s, on its contemporaries in Young Ireland, who sought Irish freedom.
The history of modern Ireland is in many ways the history of nationalism, the consuming search for a nation-state free from British control. It is the journey of one of the most powerful ideas in Western Europe, the shadow of which is still felt north and south of the Irish border today. In the 1840s, after the Catholic Emancipation Campaign of Daniel O'Connell and before the revolutionary agitation of the Fenians, this quest for national autonomy fell to a body of men known as Young Ireland. In print, debate, and even an 1848 uprising, they led the campaign for a liberated Ireland. Where did their idea of a unified Irish nation come from? They said, from the Celtic soil of Ireland herself. True enough. But it was also drawn from a romantic vision of nationhood which was shared across the Irish Sea, within the imperial oppressor, England herself. This is the story of how Young Ireland was crafted from the ideas of Young England. It is an inquiry into what a philosophy of Irish liberation owed to a high Tory cabal centred around the mesmeric political figure of Benjamin Disraeli. It is the story of a British idea used to tear apart the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland.
When boyhood's fire was in my blood, I read of ancient freemen. For Greece and Rome who bravely stood, 300 men and three men.
By the names inscribed in history's page, names that are England's noblest heritage.
And then I prayed I yet might see our fetter rent in twain, and Ireland, long a province, be a nation once again.
Names that shall live for yet unnumbered years, shrined in our hearts, with Cressy and Poitiers.
And from that time, through wildest woe, that hope has shone, a far light, nor could love's brightest summer glow outshone that solemn starlight. It seemed to watch above my head, in forum, field and fane. Its angels sang around my bed, a nation once again.
Let wealth and commerce, laws and learning die, but leave us still our old nobility.
But the aristocracy of old England was under pressure from the Republic of Letters in the early 1800s. Radical philosophy, rather than noblesse oblige, was the coming force. With the Industrial Revolution had arrived the new philosophy of utilitarianism.
The Octagon Chamber in the Flaxman Gallery at the heart of University College London is a temple to learning, knowledge and study. Between its neoclassical arches are tablets celebrating classical virtues all around me. Above it all stands a picture depicting Jeremy Bentham looking over architectural plans for University College London. But Bentham was far more than the inspiration for this university. To many, he was also the architect of early Victorian Britain, the man whose ideas defined the morality, the politics, and the economics of Britain during the Industrial Revolution.
The said truth is that it is the greatest happiness of the greatest number that is the measure of right and wrong.
Joining me among the bookshelves of UCL Library amidst suspiciously hard-working students is Dr. Lawrence Goldman, fellow in modern history at St. Peter's College, Oxford, and editor of the Dictionary of National Biography. And with us also, Professor Jane Humphreys, president of the Economic History Society and fellow of All Souls College, Oxford. Lawrence, how did the philosophy of utilitarianism emerge in Britain in the late 18th, early 19th century?
It's a very radical idea, utilitarianism. It's taken up by people we call the philosophic radicals in the 1820s. It wants an end to aristocratic privilege, to govern by interest. It wants, as it were, a society which is rationally designed to benefit the most, the majority. To do that, however, it's not just a question of rolling back the state. That is certainly the case. They want efficiency, they want economy. But in order to get to that position, there's a kind of a paradox which one sees often in laissez-faire philosophies, which is that the state must take power, must centralise administration, must in a way force people into certain rational categories and boxes, if you like, must redesign institutions in order that there should be a different kind of relationship between the citizen and the state. And so utilitarianism has this dual side. On the one side, we associate it with an early 19th century political economy of laissez-faire. But on another level, we see it as a very regulatory system designed, as it were, to coerce people to behave in ways that conform with the utilitarian philosophy based on efficiency and rationality.
How, Jane, did this philosophy begin to influence policy in terms of the economic policy, social policy in Britain, 1820s, 1830s?
On the one hand, you do see these ideas about the greatest good for the greatest number can be achieved by individuals pursuing their self-interest in a system of markets to which the state is neutral. So we have laissez-faire political economy, Adam Smith, Ricardo, Malthus, arguing strongly for a system of markets where the government's main role is to guarantee property rights and public finance. So the state retreats really from responsibility for directing the economy. And this is manifest in significant economic milestones like the Bank Charter Act in 1844, which removes the responsibility of the government for the control of the money supply and bases it on a gold standard. And at the same time, you've got the growing acceptance of free trade.
And I think what's wrong with utilitarianism and why it evokes great opposition and deep disquiet among other intellectuals and other political movements is that it behaves in a very draconian fashion. It imposes a new poor law in 1834. It is set up to deal with the problem of an expanding number of paupers in industrial Britain. Its solutions are very radical. It leads to the establishment of a new poor law and a poor law regime, workhouses into which those who cannot find work are to be forced, and the draconian way in which it's imposed and the lack of a kind of human sympathy, the lack of an understanding of the problems of poverty and the kinds of situations in which people will find themselves needing the support of local authorities and the state. That absence of, in a sense, an educational idea and a sense of fellow feeling with the community, this marks out the utilitarian modus operandi as well as their thought, and it leads to great opposition.
Part of the power of utilitarianism was its global reach. It was a philosophy of the Enlightenment, with followers in continental Europe, South America, and Russia. It also had a keen disciple closer to home, in the form of the leading Irish nationalist of the early 19th century, Daniel O'Connell. Professor Richard English is the author of Irish Freedom, A History of Nationalism in Ireland.
O'Connell's career focused on the two great issues of Irish nationalism. One, the constitutional relation with England, where he wanted to magnify the degree of autonomy for Ireland without breaking the connection completely. And second, increasing and augmenting the rights of Irish Catholics, particularly in relation to issues such as being able to sit in Parliament, to be a King's Counsel, to be a judge. And Catholic emancipation in the 1820s, and then after 1830, the campaign for the repeal of the Union, were the means through which he tried to address those issues.
I think what many people find surprising is O'Connell's enthusiasm for the works of Jeremy Bentham and the utilitarian school. How did those ideas fit within his political philosophy?
O'Connell was characterised by what you might call a brilliant pragmatism. His main concern was to ask how could his politics maximise the actual practical benefit for Irish people, in particular for the Irish Catholic people. In that sense, he was an instinctive Bentham supporter, and he was explicit about this. I mean, writing to Bentham himself, he referred to himself as an advocate of the greatest happiness principle. When he was elected in 1829, he wrote to Bentham saying, "You have now one Member of Parliament, your own."
It is said somewhere that Irishmen frequently catch glimpses of sublime theories without being able to comprehend the entire plan. For my part, I certainly see a part, and would wish to comprehend the details of the whole. My desire is yours. The greatest possible good to the greatest possible number. And I say, no man has ever done so much to show how this object could be realised as you have.
And there were resonances between them. O'Connell's attitude towards the Irish language, O'Connell's attitude towards the means of struggle by means of which you tried to achieve reform, were one where he wasn't really characterised by romantic nationalism. He was more somebody who said, in the real world of actual politics, what will be likely to be the best outcome, imperfect though it is, for the Irish people. So in that sense, there was a natural affinity between this deeply pragmatic lawyer O'Connell and Bentham in terms of the ideas that he was espousing on the basis of utilitarianism.
You point to O'Connell's position and role at Westminster. One of the other growing parliamentary figures of the era was Benjamin Disraeli, very hostile towards utilitarian thinking. What was the relationship between O'Connell and Disraeli?
The relationship between Disraeli and O'Connell was a very fractious one within Parliament and beyond it. At Disraeli's maiden speech in 1837, he was very hostile to O'Connell, which prompted a very sharp response from O'Connell and from the Irish MPs, who shouted Disraeli down. There was an attack by Disraeli on O'Connell, which prompted a rebuff from O'Connell and then a challenge to a duel by Disraeli. So there was a very fractious relationship between the two characters.
And was there, behind the rhetoric and the drama and the political purposes of it, a deeper philosophical divide between them? Can we point to a proper ideological division?
I think there was an ideological divide in the sense that Disraeli's hostility towards Benthamite utilitarianism was something which meant that there was an ideological hinterland behind his politics, which was utterly at odds with the way in which O'Connell was approaching his own political movement. And in that sense, I suspect you could see this as a Benthamite being attacked by someone who was very hostile to utilitarian politics within an English context within the mid-19th century.
So what was this great philosophical divide? Benjamin Disraeli and his Young England Party comprised the most sustained riposte to the harsh, mechanical philosophy of O'Connell's beloved utilitarianism. It offered a Tory, paternalist response to the divisions of cash nexus Britain, where mammon governed morality. Its credo was perhaps best recounted by Lord Egremont in Disraeli's 1845 novel, Sybil, or the Two Nations.
Our queen reigns over the greatest nation that ever existed. Which nation? Asked the younger stranger. For she reigns over two. Egremont was silent, but looked inquiringly. Yes, two nations, between whom there is no intercourse and no sympathy, who are as ignorant of each other's habits, thoughts, and feelings as if they were dwellers in different zones or inhabitants of different planets, who are formed by a different breeding, are fed by a different food, are ordered by different manners, and are not governed by the same laws. You speak of, said Egremont, hesitatingly, the rich and the poor.
This was the compelling answer which provided the philosophy for one nation, socially concerned conservatism. Richard Aldous is a historian of Young England and author of The Lion and the Unicorn.
Young England is a group of three friends and one older character, Benjamin Disraeli. The three friends are Alexander Bailey Cochrane, George Smythe and Lord John Manners. They were all educated together at Eton and Cambridge, and they developed a particular sensibility that was romantic, that looked back to the medieval period for examples, and they had a very strong sense that England needed to be revitalised, that it had lost its sense of energy, of responsibility and of values. When they get into the House of Commons, they look to Benjamin Disraeli because he is a Byronic kind of character and is also somebody who, with his way for words, knows how to court controversy. And so these three young friends agree to act together in the House of Commons and to be identified by others as a group, Young England.
What the philosophy of Young England offered was a counterweight to the liberal cheerleaders of industrialisation. While the mill owners of Manchester, the pottery barons of Stoke-on-Trent and steel magnates of Sheffield welcomed the free trade and minimal mid-Victorian state, the Young England aristocrats yearned for stability, order and hierarchy.
They raised the flag, really, of rebellion against their own party leadership, trying to establish a kind of alternative, traditional Tory politics. Peel, in the 1840s, is designing a new conservatism that would appeal to the middle classes, who traditionally, if they've had the vote, have voted for the Whigs, for the Liberals. Peel is aiming, as it were, to grab them and to design a kind of conservatism which appeals to urban property holders, not just to the traditional landed classes, the bedrock of Toryism.
Oh, would some noble dare again to raise the feudal banner of forgotten days, and live, despising slander's harmless hate, the potent ruler of his petty state.
Young England, however, try an alternative kind of politics. They begin to articulate arguments that would, as it were, link together the landed elite with the people, almost, as it were, bypassing the new middle classes.
Then would the classes, once again, feel the kind pressure of the social chain.
They would, if you like, turn the clock back to a paternalistic age before the advent of the new political economy, before ideas like laissez-faire and economic individualism had become so evidently influential in the 1820s. They would turn back the clock to a kind of organic paternalism on an 18th century model where an elite had the obligation of the people and the people knew their place, and the elite, through their support, their paternalism, would, as it were, assist and support and comfort the poor. So a highly traditional model of politics.
Manners, for example, put it into verse.
Each knew his place, king, peasant, peer or priest. The greatest owned connection with the least. From rank to rank the generous feeling ran and linked society as man to man.
So there was a very strong sense of the need for those with privilege to work with those who did not have privilege to make a better society. And in particular, Disraeli saw that even though you were looking backwards to an older time, you had to deal with the problems as they were there today. Disraeli talks about Manchester as being the Athens of the scientific age, that you couldn't ignore that. You had to deal with its problems, but maybe the answer to those problems could come by looking to examples from the past.
There was another force unhappy with the signs of the times. This acerbic Scottish philosopher could not have been more different than the Young England fops. But his criticisms of urban industrial England poured into the same well that Young Ireland would drink so deeply from.
There was no greater opponent of Benthamite utilitarianism than the so-called Sage of Chelsea, the polemicist, the author, the man of letters, Thomas Carlyle. I'm standing in the creaking attic of 24 Cheyne Row in London's Chelsea. Joining me here is Simon Heffer, Daily Telegraph columnist and a biographer of Thomas Carlyle.
Well, we're in Carlyle's soundproof room, which he had built in the early 1850s.
because he had a paranoia about noise, and he couldn't bear to hear urchins yelling in the street. Chelsea was not quite the place then that it is now, and he couldn't bear to hear horses' hooves clattering on the cobbles. But this is where he would sit and write. There's a quill pen in an inkwell. He would have breakfast with Jane and would lock himself in here until nightfall, grab a quick snack, and then get on his horse and go riding after a day of imprisonment in this room. There are no distractions in this room, unless one is distracted by pictures of Frederick the Great, which there are many, because there are no windows, and all you can see through the skylight is sky.
What was Carlyle's vision of humanity, and how did it differ from the utilitarian perspective?
In fact, he was a very humane figure and was seen as such in the 1840s and 1850s. He was desperately keen to improve the lot of the poor, and in works such as Past and Present, he talked about the shocking neglect that a post-aristocratic reformed or society that was beginning to see reform, the neglect with which it would treat poor people. He devoted himself in his writings in the early 1840s to trying to argue that the poor law needed to be reformed and that there needed to be a greater sense of social responsibility on the part of the haves towards the have-nots. And Carlyle was essentially a feudalist. If you read Past and Present, which I think is probably his greatest work in many respects, it was based on Carlyle's reading of the newly rediscovered journals of Jocelyn de Bracklond, who was a monk in the Abbey of St. Edmundsbury in the 12th century. And what Carlyle saw in Jocelyn's journals was what he called a representation of the most perfect feudal times, where every man had his place and every man was looked after by somebody else, and they could earn a living that would give them dignity and a roof over their heads and food in their bellies. And obviously that clashed violently with the reality of the industrial society.
One of those groups looking to a pre-industrial past, if not fully medieval, was the so-called Young England grouping around Lord John Manners and Benjamin Disraeli. What was the relationship between Carlyle and the Young England circle?
Distant. He had a close relationship with members of the Young Ireland circle, people like Charles Gavan Duffy, who came to this house in, I think, 1848 and saw him and convinced Carlyle to come to Ireland 2 or 3 years after the potato famine and to go around Ireland and see the state of Ireland. And Carlyle was deeply affected by that, and it was one of the provocations that led him to write the Latter-day pamphlets, which came out in 1850, and which again railed against capitalism, utilitarianism, and all those other vices that he had described.